From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. A new biography of Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers, the complicated story behind the man and the movement.
As important as charismatic leaders are, if you don't have a democratic organization, the organization could be strong for a while, but eventually will break.
Author Frank Bardaghi's new book, Trampling Out the Vintage, and the actor who plays Cesar Chavez in an upcoming film.
I'm more interested in playing the real man, so I didn't want to play him being like Gandhi, like, you know, this saint.
A profile of actor Michael Peña. And we talked to the man who has visited Spanish language living rooms and some English language ones, too, every Saturday for the past 50 years. Don Francisco.
Not exactly. Mario Luis Kreutzberger Blumenfeld.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. December of 1992, and after years of wrangling, Canada, Mexico, and the United States ratify the North American Free Trade Agreement, known as NAFTA. 20 years later, experts still argue about NAFTA's impact on the industries, labor markets, and the economies of its participating nations. Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Everybody's been arguing about NAFTA for 20 years. Tell us your perspective of what the three countries involved.
Well, I think it's been very much a mixed bag. I mean, there were expectations that it would increase growth in all three countries. It's probably had positive effects in many ways, but there were also a lot of negative effects. The basic story that I think many people were concerned about at the onset was that you would see a downward impact on wages in the United States, particularly wages of manufacturing workers. The story in Mexico, I think you'd be hard-pressed to look at Mexico and see there's a positive story there in the last two decades. Now, certainly you can't say that's all due to NAFTA. But, you know, if you look at what's happened there, there was considerable displacement in the agricultural sector, the reason being that we produce agricultural crops, corn in particular, at a much lower price than Mexico does. And when NAFTA eliminated Mexico's tariffs on imported corn, basically, it wiped out many of their farmers, which forced these people to look for jobs in some cases in Mexico. And in other cases, it led to increased immigration to the United States. Mexico's growth over this period, its per capita growth, actually has been the slowest of any country in Latin America. So if you go down the list of things, I mean, have other problems, you know, the drug lords there, the drug trade. You're pretty hard to tell a very positive story about Mexico. And again, I don't mean to blame that all on NAFTA by any means. I'm just saying that when you look at that, if NAFTA was a positive, it certainly wasn't enough to outweigh all the other negatives that have hit Mexico.
There was a recent piece in the Washington Post that basically said with NAFTA, the Mexican economy, the Mexican middle class, these huge Costcos, you know, these big box stores, the economy is booming. You have people who are working, and they're saying a lot of this has to do with NAFTA. So you're saying not so fast.
That's right. I mean, there's no doubt about it. NAFTA did help bring a lot of jobs to Mexico, but it also cost a lot of jobs. And, you know, again, I think the net, it's very, very hard to sort out whether the net's been a positive or negative. But the idea Mexico's economy is booming is just simply not true. As I say, it's had absolutely the worst growth of any country in Latin America. So I think we have to redefine the definition of booming downward if we're going to call Mexico's economy a boom over the last two decades or even over the last decade.
Can you talk about how NAFTA has impacted jobs and wages in the United States, for example?
Well, the basic story there is that you've had a lot of firms relocate to Mexico. So you've had manufacturing operations with General Electric, General Motors. You've had a lot of companies move their operations to Mexico. We're importing a lot of manufactured goods from Mexico, which we didn't used to do. I mean, we did import manufacturing goods even before NAFTA. But the amount of manufacturing goods, this is car parts, sometimes assembled cars, all sorts of electronic items, clothes, textiles, wide range of manufacturing goods that we're now importing from Mexico that we were not importing back before NAFTA, say in 1992. And we do export to them as well, but we import considerably more than we export. As I say, $60 billion a year is about 0.4% of our economy. That's a fairly large trade deficit.
And then in terms of American jobs, that means?
That would translate probably into somewhere in the order of 600,000-700,000 jobs. So it's a substantial number of manufacturing jobs. So it's, you know, again, that's not the end of the world, but that's hardly trivial either.
So during President Obama's 2008 campaign, there was a lot of memorable talk about renegotiating NAFTA. But what in fact happened? Is it just going to continue to be reauthorized without any renegotiation or looking at it critically?
I'd be surprised if there's any substantive renegotiation. Now, the one area that may affect NAFTA, or I should say trade relations between the United States and Mexico, is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a pact that the United States has brought in several Latin American and Pacific nations on. And the intention is to have that expand to include, well, certainly a wider range. I think we have 9 at this point. That would really in many ways expand NAFTA. I don't think it would really amount to renegotiation. What it would do is impose stronger conditions on investment, intellectual property, patents and copyrights, for example. But I don't think anyone could really call that a renegotiation of NAFTA.
Thanks, Dean, for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. For news updates throughout the week, visit us at latinousa.org or follow us on Twitter, where we are LatinoUSA. That's all one word. And we're back in 30 segundos. That's 30 seconds. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Before his death in 1993, Cesar Chavez was probably the most famous Latino in the United States. The United Farm Workers Union, which he founded, won major victories in wages and working conditions, often using high-profile tactics such as the national grape and lettuce boycotts of the 1960s and 70s. In his lifetime, Chavez was both celebrated and criticized. But after his death, he became a national monument, achieving that oftentimes bland sainthood accorded other famous leaders, such as Martin Luther King. A new biography gives us a more nuanced and human view of the labor and civil rights leader. It's called Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers. Author Frank Bardicky joins us now, and welcome to Latino USA, Frank.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for asking me.
So you worked on this book for 20 years?
Well, not quite 20, 15, but it felt like 25.
So you could have written a book just about Cesar Chavez, but in fact, you write about the two souls of the United Farm Workers. So Cesar Chavez and the two souls of the United Farm Workers, what are the two souls that you're talking about?
Well, the two souls that I'm talking about is the United Farm Workers was actually a fairly complicated institution, and it was a combination of a boycott advocacy group and a farm workers union. So that the staff of the union was more involved in boycott work and in advocacy for farm workers than it was actually involved in the union itself. And it was a combination. And the union itself became more oriented towards the boycott work than it did to the work in the fields.
Interestingly, you know, when people think of the United Farm Workers, they immediately think that the UFW was very much in support of Mexicanos and Mexican immigrants. In fact, it's a little bit more complicated than that. Cesar Chavez and the UFW at times were very much at odds with the Mexican-born workers versus the U.S.-born Mexican-Americans as well.
Yes, that was a reflection of the first people that they began organizing. Then the UFW begins at the end of the Bracero program, where the Bracero program was what we call now a guest worker program, where contracted Mexican workers came to California to work in the fields, and they stayed here as long as the harvest lasted, and then they were sent home. And one of the first struggles that Gilbert and Cesar and Dolores were involved in was trying to stop that program. They and a bunch of other folks were successful in doing that. And after the Bracero program ended, what happened was that the border was thrown open and people were able to cross to come back into the fields either as people without papers or as green carters. So this enclave of grape workers around Delano considered that new wave of immigration a threat to their jobs. The UFW was known as an organization of domestic farm workers, and they were opposed to green carters who worked in the fields and to people without papers who came to work in the fields, not just when they broke their strikes, but in general. And this continued out throughout UFW history until 1974. Eventually, the fields became dominated by Mexican immigrants, with papers and without. And the union itself became known as what people would call a pocho union. And this division between the domestic farm workers, who were a shrinking minority, and the Mexican immigrants, who were a growing majority, worked against the union.
Now, you talk about Gilberto Padilla. Most people, again, don't know him. They don't know the names of Helen Chavez. You also mentioned Dolores Huerta. So who were these people? Clearly, they were the team around Cesar Chavez.
Well, you know, Gilbert, as I said, was Secretary Treasurer of the United Farm Workers for a long way. He was one of the original founders of the United Farm Workers. Dolores played an extremely important role, especially in terms of the boycott. I mean, she was a face of the UFW. Earlier attempts to build unions in the fields had focused on the men, and the UFW quite consciously set out to change that. And it was very important to them to bring the women on board.
Were it not for Cesar's wife, Helen, he wouldn't have been able to do what he did.
Oh, of course. I mean, it was not only that there was a woman behind a great man. She was involved in the UFW's financial dealings. But again, what she represented was the full participation of women in the early National Farm Workers Association, which was a great departure from earlier attempts to build unions and was one of the reasons that the farm workers were successful.
So one area in which Cesar Chavez was innovative in his organizing was how he incorporated his deep Catholicism and his activist traditions in terms of the work that he did with farm workers. So how did this all work together?
Cesar was authentically a religious man. It did him well politically. He was a part of what we call Catholic social action. The many, many farm workers in the fields were also serious Catholics. So the leaders of the rank and file among the Mexican farm workers, these were green carters, ex-braceros, the sons of braceros, many of them were undocumented workers. These folks came from a different tradition in Mexico, a tradition of secular anti-Catholicism. These folks were cardenistas, more interested in the problems in the fields than they are in the problems of the boycott. And they were suspicious of the Catholic Church. And it was another difference inside the union, which caused internal disagreements and fights and struggles.
What would be the meta story about Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers in terms of the American labor movement?
The meta message is democracy, because one of the reasons that the union had these great internal fights is because it was not as structured democratically. There was no way that the rank and file farm worker could be elected onto the UFW staff. I think that the meta story here is as important as charismatic, dynamic leaders are. If you don't have a democratic organization, the organization could be strong for a while, but eventually it will be brittle and break.
Frank, thanks so much for all the work that you did with this book.
Well, thank you, Maria.
Frank Bardicky is the author of Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers. His book won the 2012 Hillman Prize in Book Journalism, and he spoke to us from the studios of KUSB in Santa Cruz, California. A new film about the life of Cesar Chavez is due out next year. It's being directed by Diego Luna and will star Michael Peña as the farm worker advocate. This is Michael Peña's Time in the Sun. The 36-year-old actor also co-starred with Jake Gyllenhaal in this year's gritty cop drama, End of Watch. Lily Percy has this profile of the Chicago-born Michael Peña.
Michael Peña has been acting in Hollywood for years. For a long time, he survived on bit parts in movies and TV shows. Then in 2004, his breakthrough came when he played a Chicano locksmith in the Oscar-winning film Crash.
When Crash came out, the first job that I got after that was World Trade Center, which I was like, whoa.
Peña is charismatic and confident with a quick wit. Crash brought him into the spotlight, but Oliver Stone's World Trade Center marked his first role as a leading man. Peña starred opposite Nicolas Cage as real-life Port Authority police officer Will Jimeno. They were trapped in the rubble on 9/11.
Sarge! John!
Yeah?
Most amazing thing just happened. I saw Jesus. He had a bottle of water, but I didn't drink it. He's telling us something, Sarge.
Director Oliver Stone didn't even audition Peña before deciding that he was right for the role. That's rare, but it didn't surprise Felix Sanchez.
I think there's a certain amount of intensity with Michael.
Sanchez is the chairman of the National Hispanic Foundation for the Arts, which pinpointed Peña as the next Hispanic actor to watch in 2006.
I think that Michael is just hell-bent on making this a big career, and he's not going to settle for no.
Not settling is something that Peña learned from his parents, Eleuterio and Nicolasa.
My dad grew up in this place called Purificación, Jalisco, and my mom grew up in this place called Charcas.
Both of Peña's parents are from rural Mexico, where they farmed. They each emigrated to Chicago, where they met, married, and eventually got their green cards. They raised Peña and his brother in a predominantly Mexican neighborhood in the South Side.
I didn't really realize I was poor until I left. You know, yeah, my shoes were battered or whatever, but I'd go to the park. You know, me and my brother would play ball. My dad would teach us some soccer moves and stuff. And then we'd go home and it was a full day.
Peña's dad worked in a button factory, but he never lost his love for farming. He maintained his own small garden in their backyard, growing cucumbers, tomatoes, onions, and peppers.
There was a perimeter that we couldn't step into. And that was his little Mexico.
Acting never entered Peña's mind, but he was charming and good at impressions. So when his best friend's mom found out that they were holding movie auditions at a local high school, she pushed him to go.
And the guy says, so can you act? And I was like, I don't know, we're going to find out. You tell me. He thought I was a smartass, and I was like, no, but I'm serious. I have no idea.
Peña didn't get the part, but he was cast as a featured extra. 3 weeks later, at 19, he moved to Hollywood.
You know, I said my goodbyes, and I remember my dad and my mom on the porch waving, and my dad holding my mom because my mom was crying a little bit because she's like, she thought I was just going to test it out. She didn't know that I was going to stay there.
Peña has come a long way since then. He's one of the most successful Latino actors working in film today, portraying Latino characters in mainstream movies for a mainstream audience. More than once, he's changed the name of an Anglo character to a Hispanic one. Felix Sanchez credits Peña's success to his ability to make every role uniquely his own.
Michael tends to go big in these roles, and you feel that, and you are inspired by it. And I think that if you're a young Mexican-American or you're a young Latino anywhere in the country watching that, you feel pride and you feel determined, as he is, to succeed.
And that, he says, has an impact that's even bigger than the big screen.
It shows that we're part of the American society that we know. It shows the modernity of our culture and our presence in the United States. And I think that Michael takes that a lot further. I think that he makes those characters feel that they are alive, that they are real, and that they are three-dimensional, and that adds a lot of dignity to the roles that he has created.
In his next film, Peña will break even more ground. He'll be playing farm labor organizer Cesar Chavez in a film directed by Diego Luna out next year. Those are big shoes to fill, but Peña has worked hard at it. He spent months interviewing Chavez's family members and friends, and he learned what Chavez was like out of the limelight when he wasn't leading a crowd.
I'm more interested in playing the real man as opposed to, like, the way people thought of him. So I didn't want to play him being like Gandhi, like, you know, this saint.
Peña still remembers when he called his dad to break the news.
He's usually not one to show much emotion. I don't think I've ever seen much emotion out of the man. I told him, I was like, Dad, you know what? I just booked a part of Cesar Chavez. There's like a 10-second pause, and he's like, that's nice. And that was that. You know, I know what it meant. I was like, wow, that's pretty cool, you know, to stump the old man.
Peña says it's an honor to play Chavez, who is a hero to many Latinos, especially Mexican-American farm workers, who pick grapes in the fields of California. Chavez may not be a household name yet, Peña says, but he hopes with this film, that will change. For Latino USA, I'm Lily Percy.
He's been el rey of Saturday nights for 50 years. Don Francisco, coming up on Latino USA, no se vayan. We'll be right back.
It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. If you grew up in a Spanish-speaking household anytime in the past 50 years, there's a good chance you grew up with Don Francisco on Saturday nights. He's the host of Sábado Gigante, which translates into Giant Saturday, the longest-running variety TV show in the world and one of the most successful Spanish-language TV shows in the United States. It's the games, the musical performances, the skits, the skimpy outfits, and the cheesy audience sing-alongs that made the Chilean host an entertainment icon for Latinos in the U.S. and abroad. And we are so happy to welcome El Mero Mero, Don Francisco, from the Univision Studios in Miami. Bienvenido a Latino USA, Don Francisco.
Thank you, Maria. It's a pleasure that you have me in your program.
And I have to say, it's really wonderful to hear you speaking in English, Don Francisco. You have a beautiful accent.
Thank you very much. It's not my mother language, but I will try always my best.
You know, I'm calling you Don Francisco, but in your house, your name is actually Mario Luis Grenzenberger Blumenfeld. ¿Estoy correcta?
Not exactly. It's Mario Luis Kreuzberger Blumenfeld. It's not very Spanish.
How do you end up as Don Francisco then?
I started acting in a Jewish club. And I did an impression of a Jewish guy that couldn't speak well Spanish, and I put a nickname on him. That name was Don Francisco. And at the beginning, you know, people are not recognizing me on the streets because my last name was so difficult. Then I put it under my name, and after 8 weeks, I put it over my name, and then I took off my name, and since then, I'm Don Francisco.
So I remember the first time that I saw Sábado Gigante. What made me stop and watch La Verdad, Don Francisco, was all of the audience members singing along to the commercials. What's up with that?
I got the idea from an American host. I'm talking about Johnny Carson.
Oh.
Can you remember when Johnny Carson was doing that commercial with Alpo? You are very young.
Yes, of course. Alpo, of course.
Yeah, that was a product for dogs. And then I started with the idea of also singing. Because I'm not a good singer, but it was always my dream to sing. That was an opportunity because I made the program for myself, like a suit by measurement, you know?
So when was the first time that you remember watching Johnny Carson, Don Francisco? And were you in Chile at the time?
No, I went to New York in 1959. I was sent by my father to learn as a men's clothes designer. That's my only really profession. I became a men's clothes designer in 1959. I came with 19 years old, not talking any English, but I learned fast. And after 2 years, I went back to my father and I brought him my title. At the same time, I discovered a TV set. It was inside the room. It was very similar to the radio that we have in the living room in Chile, with the only difference that instead of having a piece of cloth in front, was a piece of glass. And when I saw that when they went on, you were able to listen and to watch at the same time, I was amazed.
So urban legend had it that you were flying in and out of Miami every week to do the show, Sábado Gigante. Is that true?
I came from Chile every Saturday night, and I went back every Wednesday night. I was living 11 days in Miami, 11 days in Santiago de Chile, and 8 nights over the plane.
Ay, Dios mío. So, Sábado Gigante originally aired in Chile, 1962.
Yes.
Can you take us back to that very first day?
At the end of 61, I saw that television was starting because we had the World Cup soccer in 1962. After the World Cup, I went to the station and I said, I know more television than everybody here. I was watching for 2 years because I watched many hours every day only to try to learn some English. And you can see that I haven't learned so much.
You're doing fabulously. So what is the formula, Don Francisco? I mean, of course, everybody now wants to know the formula of keeping a television show successful for 50 years.
What we do is like a soup. It's a soup that has a lot of ingredients. The difference of the show, it's because we add and we take off some ingredients every week. But we keep always the flavor of the soup of Sábado Gigante.
Which is a mixture of a lot of fun, a lot of laughter, a lot of product selling, but there's always something that you do on the show that has some kind of social connection, some kind of message.
Yes.
Why do that in a show that is dedicated to partying, essentially?
Because life is a mixture of everything. And that show is representing life.
Don Francisco, thank you so much for all of your passion and your love and your commitment to the work that you do. You, of course, have fans all over the world, and here's one of them. Thank you. Muchísimas gracias.
Thank you, Maria, for having me in your program.
Don Francisco is the host of the weekly TV show Sábado Gigante. He spoke to us from the Univision studios in Miami, Florida. And now some thoughts on the passing of singer Jenny Rivera. Authentic was the word that came up most often when people talked about Jenny Rivera. The Mexican-American singer was called the diva of banda, the brass-driven musical style from Sinaloa, Mexico. But what propelled Rivera to the mega stardom she enjoyed was not her voice, her looks, or her antics. It was the opposite of the qualities we associate with divas. It was her humility. Latina teens are likely to be the hardest hit by Rivera's death. They looked up to her less because she made wonderful dance music, which she did, or because of her radiant smile, always on. It was because they connected to the honesty in her songs. Young Latinas may be a favorite target for marketers, but they're also often targets for laws that disempower them and pressures that bring on high rates of depression. Like many of her fans, Rivera moved between a Mexican world and an American one. And like many of her fans, she struggled, with 5 kids to raise, with partners who abused her. But she did not keep those struggles under wraps. When she talked about them, sang about them, even exposed them, she put a little bit of real back into reality TV. She let us see her at her most vulnerable. That is why some of the most vulnerable in our country saw themselves in her. What she communicated to her fans was, "Life is hard, but I'm doing it, and I want to take you along for the ride." Now that Rivera is gone, we are the ones responsible to keep her voice loud, with honesty, authenticity, and fearlessness. That's what makes a real diva. Quiero una última parranda por ahí en mi funeral. And for this week, that's Latino USA. If you have any comments or suggestions, go old school and pick up the phone. Dial 646-571-1228. That's 646-571-1228. We love to hear your voice. Just tell us how to say your name and where you're calling from. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Nadia Raymond, Andres Caballero, Lita Hartman, and Michael Jones. We had production help this week from Manoli Wetherill and NPR New York. Additional engineering this week from Michael Johnson. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group in Harlem. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is funded in part by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.